Chapter 6. The police cruiser dropped Steele off at the front entrance of his building and started to pull away, but before he could go in, he was intercepted by Linda Tellerman, who came running out of a car parked several yards away. "Lieutenant Steele, wait!" He resisted an impulse to dash into the lobby and stopped, and as a result, the shots missed him. The high explosive round slammed into the lobby door and blew out the thick glass. "Get down!" he shouted as he dropped to the ground and rolled. A veteran of covering street battles between gangs and the police, she immediately dropped down to the sidewalk and started scrambling back on her belly for the shelter of her car. The unseen gunman fired again on full auto, and Steele was forced to scramble away from the entrance as the rounds exploded all around him, which was precisely the gunman's intention, to force him away from shelter and out into the open. The officer who dropped him off was halfway down the block, and as the building security guards responded to the shots, he spun the patrol unit around, racing back to cover Steele. He jumped the curb and pulled in close to Steele, interposing the armored vehicle between Steele and the gunman. He threw open the driver's side door and slid over, allowing Steele to enter. He was already calling him for backup, but Steele didn't get inside. Not yet. Using the car for shelter, he quickly scanned the buildings across the way, following the report of the rifle shots. Or the rapport, whatever. He zoomed in on tight focus and spotted the gunman just as he was moving back from the edge of the roof. He leaped into the driver's seat and spun the vehicle around, speeding towards the building's entrance. He jumped the curb, and even before the officer could complete his call, he was already out and running inside the building, shouting back over his shoulder to the officer, "Stay there! Have security cover the entrance! Nobody gets out!" If the gunman ditched his weapon and came down in the elevator, the officers would stop him. Steele went right for the stairs, taking them three at a time at top speed, his legs churning as he hurtled up the stairs. Faster than any normal man could run, heading for the roof. He made it in a matter of moments. The gun port slid back in his right hand as the pistol barrel came out. He stood inside the open door just a moment, his hearing turned up, listening for the slightest sound. Then he dove out through the doorway and rolled. No one shot at him. He came up quickly, scanning the rooftop all around him, but there was no sign of the gunman. And then his ears picked up the telltale sounds of boots on metal. He ran over to the edge of the roof. The gunman was already more than halfway down the fire escape. The rifle slung across his back. Even with his superior speed, Steele knew he couldn't catch the man before he hit the street. He looked down and saw Linda Tellerman hurrying across the street with her cameraman right behind her. The fool woman stopped on the sidewalk right between the two buildings and started setting up so her cameraman could cover the building entrance where the patrol unit was parked. He saw her turn to the camera, holding her mic. The gunman couldn't fail to see her. He'd be on the ground in seconds, and he'd be able to get to her and use her as a hostage before the men covering the front of the building realized what was going on. "Linda!" Steele shouted at the top of his lungs. "Get back!" She heard him and looked up. Then, incredulously, Steele saw her turn to her cameraman and point straight up at him. As the man trained his camera on Steele, standing at the roof's edge, she stood right where she was and started her on-the-scene report.
"Jesus!"
Steele said. He looked down. The gunman was almost to the street level. Even with his computer-controlled accuracy, Steele couldn't be certain that a shot wouldn't be deflected by the fire escape, and if he waited till the gunman hit the street, he couldn't take that chance. He retracted his gun, looked down, and took a deep breath.
"Shit!"
he said through gritted teeth, and dropped right over the side. He fell straight down, flailing his arms in an attempt to keep his body from turning, praying that his fall would be straight and not angle out away from the fire escape. The wind rushed by him as he fell past the astonished gunman. Then he lunged out and grabbed the railing on the foot of the fire escape, clamping his nice steel fingers around it with all his might. He grunted as his body slammed against the side of the fire escape with tremendous force, making it shudder with the impact. But he managed to retain his grip, and his nice steel shoulder joints held. He pulled himself up and over the iron steel railing. The gunman, just above him, had recovered from his shock and was quickly unslinging his rifle. Steele raced up the steps towards him. The gunman brought his rifle up. Steele raised his right arm, gun barrel sliding out of the port in his hand. He fired. The 10mm bullet struck the rifle, knocking it out of the gunman's grasp. Then Steele was on him. He knocked the gunman down, then picked him up by the ankles and swung him out over the side, holding him suspended three floors up, head down. The gunman cried out in fear.
"Who hired you?"
"Don't!" shouted the gunman. "Don't drop me! Please!" Steele let go with one hand. The gunman screamed in terror as Steele held him upside down with one hand. "No, for God's sake, don't!
Who hired you?"
All right, I'll talk. Just don't drop me, please. God,
was it Boradini?
Yes, it was Tommy B. Please, don't let go. Jesus, God, please." Steele hauled him back up to the fire escape. The man collapsed onto the landing.
"Jesus Christ," he gasped. "You ain't fucking human."
Steele reached down and hauled him up to his feet by his shirt front. He quickly patted him down and relieved him of a pistol fastened down in his shoulder holster inside his jacket and a switchblade knife inside his pants pocket. The man had no other weapons. The men covering the front entrance had seen where Linda Tellerman had trained her camera and rushed around to the side of the building. They stood at the bottom of the fire escape with their weapons out.
"Go ahead and set him down, Lieutenant! We've got him covered!"
"Get down there before I change my mind and throw you over," Steele said to the gunman.
The man wasted no time scrambling down to the waiting officers. As he got off the fire escape, the police backup units came screeching up. Linda Tillerman was down there with her cameraman, filming the whole thing. Another freak show for the evening news. Steele turned away and leaned back against the stairs of the fire escape, looking up at the roof. He exhaled heavily.
Jesus! I can't believe I did that!
He said to himself. If he'd missed... His stomach churned and he fought down the rising bile. As he climbed down, Linda Tillerman and her cameraman were filming the gunman being cuffed and taken away. Then she came rushing over to him.
That was really stupid,
Steele said to her before she could start talking. You could have gotten yourself killed. She waved to the cameraman behind her to stop taping. Then she turned to him and grinned.
I'm not the one who jumped off an 18-story building, she said. That was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I've got it all on tape. It'll be incredible.
Is that all you care about?
It's my job, Steele. And when the people of the city see what you've just done, you'll be a hero. Every kid in Midtown's going to worship you.
Yeah, and what happens when some kid jumps off a roof because we saw me do it on TV?
Steele asked.
You gonna film the wet mess on the sidewalk and his mother screaming with grief? You gonna stick a mic in her face and ask her how she feels about what happened?
Why don't you like me, Steele?
For the same reason I don't like all reporters, Steele said. All you're interested in is sensationalism. You don't really give a damn about the people, about their feelings.
That's not true, she said.
Isn't it?
If you gave me half a chance, I'd try to prove it to you.
Like the last time, when you told me you weren't taping, but you recorded what I said just the same?
Okay, you're right. I'm sorry about that. Like it or not, Steele, your news. But I tried to report that story the way I thought you would have wanted me to. Not in a sensational manner, but in human terms.
Yeah, I especially like the way you missed it up on camera when you said I told you I just didn't want to be a freak show, Steele said wryly. I thought that was very effective. You should have been an actress, Miss Tillerman.
What makes you think I was acting? She asked softly and turned to her cameraman. Come on, she said. Let's get back to the studio.
Wait, said Steele.
She turned.
Okay. Go ahead and roll your tape, he said to the cameraman.
The cameraman glanced at her, then raised his minicam. She looked at Steele questioningly, then raised her microphone. When Ice and Raven returned from their shopping excursion, they saw the damage to the lobby door and immediately guessed what must have happened. The security guards confirmed their suspicions, but reassured them that Steele was all right and that the hitman had been apprehended. Raven looked very different with clothes on. Before, wrapped in Ice's jacket and later in Steele's bathrobe, she had looked like a lost waif, a vulnerable little girl, albeit with a hard edge to her. Now she looked a lot less vulnerable. Her face still bore the evidence of her beating, but she had hidden most of it with skillfully applied makeup. She'd had her hair styled and her nails done, and she came in wearing a slinky, close-fitting black knit dress with a short skirt, stockings, and black high-heeled pumps that accentuated the natural beauty of her legs. The outfit brought out her trashy sexuality. God.
The guards told us what happened,
she said, doing a model's pirouette for him.
Ice helped me pick it out. You think it's sexy?
It is that, said Steele.
Ice came in loaded down with boxes of clothing.
What'd you do? Buy out the whole store?
We picked up a few things,
she said, slightly defensive.
It's okay, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it's okay.
Looked like you had some trouble,
Ice said. Steele nodded.
Tommy B hired himself a hitman. Took some shots at me from the roof across the street.
I told you they were going to come after you,
Raven said.
And they're not going to stop. The Borodinis have a lot of soldiers. They'll just keep after you until they get you.
Then we'll just have to get them first,
said Steele. He turned to Ice.
I've got Gates putting together a complete file on the Borodini Enclave, he said. We should have it ready for me sometime this evening. Then we'll see what we can do about putting together a plan of action.
You're going to try to hit the Enclave?
Raven said.
That's crazy.
Maybe, Steele said, which is why they won't be expecting us to try it.
You'll never get inside,
she said.
That place is like a fortress.
Which is why we'll need your help, said Steele. I need you to tell me everything you know about the Borodini Enclave and what goes on in there.
So does that mean I can stay? You're going to let me help?
Yeah, said Steele. You can stay.
I'm standing here with Lieutenant Donovan Steele, said Linda Tellerman, who, as you just saw, dramatically foiled an attempt against his life moments ago outside his building on Park Avenue. Lieutenant Steele, do you have any idea who was behind this assassination attempt?
Yes, I know exactly who was behind it. The man confessed to me that he was hired to kill me by Tommy Borodini.
Victor Borodini's son?
That's correct.
Do you think this had anything to do with what happened last night when you destroyed that warehouse allegedly belonging to Victor Borodini? She asked.
There's nothing alleged about it, Steele said. That warehouse was full of ordnance, stolen from a federal armory. It was also full of drugs meant for the streets of no man's land in Midtown. The contraband was being guarded by Victor Borodini's men, along with members of the Skull Street Gang, who weren't for Borodini.
The station received a call last night tipping us off to what happened at that warehouse, Linda said. The caller identified himself as Steele. Is that the same man who's the leader of the Skulls?
Correct, said Steele. Only Ice was ousted from the position as leader of the Skulls because he refused to take orders from Victor Borodini. As a result, Borodini put out a contract on him. Ice is now cooperating with the authorities to help bring Victor Borodini to justice.
So he was the one who tipped you off about that warehouse?
That's correct. When we arrived, we found the stolen arms and drugs. We also found a rape in progress. The Skulls were brutalizing a young woman while Victor Borodini's people watched. Under the circumstances, there was no time to call in for backup. We had to move in fast. They resisted arrest, and in the ensuing gun battle, the warehouse caught fire and was destroyed. But we did manage to get the young woman out. For obvious reasons, her identity is being protected.
So you think the attempt against your life today was a direct result of that?
I have no doubt about it. Victor Borodini takes a dim view of anything that cuts into his profits. I have it on very good authority that he's put a contract out on me. Word on the street is that I'm worth $500,000 to him dead.
Doesn't that frighten you? She asked.
No, it doesn't frighten me, said Steele. I'm not afraid of maggots. And in case Victor Bordini's watching, I'd like to tell him that the authorities are fed up with his two-bit crime lords who pose a threat as legitimate businesses and libertarians while they work behind the scenes against the people of this city, using the gangs to terrorize innocent civilians. It's past time that Victor Borodini and people like him were exposed for the scum they really are. Gangsters who seized control of the city's outlying areas against the people's will and are using people they're claiming to protect as hostages to keep themselves from being driven out. I'm personally serving notice on Victor Borodini that I'm going to do everything in my power to shut down his criminal operations in the city. And if either he or his son dare to show their faces outside their criminal enclave on Long Island, which I very much doubt they'll have the guts to do, they'll be arrested for conspiracy to commit murder, trafficking in drugs and stolen goods, black marketeering, kidnapping, and violation of the federal racketeering statutes. And on behalf of the federal government, I'm extending an offer of a reward, protection, and full immunity from prosecution to anyone who's willing to come forward with information leading to the arrest of Victor Borodini and his son, Tommy Borodini, or information relating to any of the criminal operations in the city. And if the Borodinis want to send any more of their hired killers after me, you tell them that I'm waiting.
There you have it, Linda Tellerman said, turning to the camera. The gauntlet's been thrown down, the battle lines are drawn, and Victor Borodini thumbed the remote and control and turned off the TV in disgust, then threw the remote control unit across the room. He reached for the phone.
Get Tommy in here, he snapped.
A moment later, the phone on Tommy Bordini's nightstand rang. He ignored it. Oh, God. Concentrating his attentions on the energetic 14-year-old girl in bed with him. But the ringing was insistent. He swore and picked it up. What the hell is it?
Sorry to disturb you, Mr. Borodini, said the voice on the other end. But it's your father. He wants to see you right away.
Tommy B took a deep breath and let it out slowly. A summons from the old man was not to be ignored. All right, tell him I'll be right there. He started to get out of bed and pull his pants on. Oh, God.
You're not going out now, the girl said. Christ, I was almost there.
All right. Shut up.
Tommy!
She whined plaintively, reaching for his belt. He twisted away. Shut up, I said. Stay here. I'll be back. He finished getting dressed, checked his appearance in the mirror, and then hurried to his father's wing of the estate. Unless there was specific business to be taken care of, he rarely saw his father, even though they lived in the same house. It was a very large house, more like a fortress, really, and they occupied separate wings of the estate. Tommy B showed his father the proper filial devotion and respect, as was expected of him, but he labored under no illusions that his father liked him, much less loved him.
Nor did he really love his father, for that matter. Victor Borodini was not the sort of man who inspired love, even in his sons. What he inspired was fear. He knew it, enjoyed it, and made the most of it. He could put more menace into a few soft syllables than a dozen screamers in full howl could generate. And, as the eldest son, Tommy was somehow expected to live up to that. He did his best, but despite all his inherent viciousness, it was never quite enough. His younger brothers, Rick and Polly, had a much easier time of it, not being first in line for the throne. Rick, at 26, had something of their father's class and style, for which Tommy hated him, because no matter how well he liked to dress, he still looked like a cheap hood, while Rick looked like he staped out of the pages of a fashion magazine. But Rick was empty. If there was anything going on upstairs, it was concealed behind a maze of walls. He seemed completely unemotional. And though he was not well-liked, he could command respect. On numerous occasions, especially in dealing with the street gangs, he had proved himself a good soldier in the Borodini family. As for 19-year-old Polly, he was much more like their departed mother, who had died of cancer when Polly was just 8 years old. He had her smoldering, dark good looks, but he was a fragile boy, quiet, passive, and submissive. Polly was the kind of guy who, when he walked into a room, you got the feeling somebody just left. He was good at taking care of business, so long as it was done on paper. He was smart and detail-oriented, but he simply couldn't handle people. He was walking wallpaper. Tommy had once overheard a couple of the men talking, not knowing that he was within earshot, and one of them had laughingly suggested that Tommy, Ricky, and Polly were like three separate fragments of one personality. Rick all cool and lethal competence, but cold and insubstantial as a shadow. Polly smart as a whip, yet painfully shy. A nice guy, but basically a nebbish and a bit too feminine to suit their tastes. And Tommy, a seething cauldron of emotions. A firecracker with too short a fuse just waiting to blow up in someone's face. An ice pick, a calculator, and a hand grenade, the man had said. If the old man could have put them all together in one body, he might have really had something. Tommy had not let on that he had overheard their conversation. Their comments rankled. He did not like to think of himself as lacking something that his brothers had, and it galled him that his father's people talked like that behind his back. Polly would have probably agreed with them, the way he always tried to agree with everybody to avoid any kind of conflict. Rick probably wouldn't have given a shit, but what they had said had burned in Tommy's gut like a bleeding ulcer, and he became more determined than ever to prove them wrong. He threw his weight around and handled his authority like a bludgeon, but all he succeeded in doing was reinforcing their opinion of him. He had their unquestioning obedience, but instead of treating with respect, they tended to tiptoe around him like one would tiptoe around a vicious dog that was liable to snap without warning and rip off a chunk of thigh. And though he didn't know it, they had bestowed another nickname on him. Tommy the Bug, as in Bug House. They were very careful not to use it in his presence. They still talked about the working over that he gave his girlfriend before he gave her to that pimp. Christ, he damn near killed her. Then he turned her over to some of his sleazy hairball grunts, then sat there and watched them do her. Jesus. He was a fucking bug, all right. The old man would have burst a blood vessel if he had known about that. All right, so the girl got out of line and cut him. But she was family, and you don't treat family that way. Hell, they'd been practically engaged, and Tommy thrown that other little chippy in her face. What else did he expect? A girl with any self-respect, what else could she have done? He had it coming. He was a bug, and he had short eyes besides. He'd never have the stuff to fill the old man's shoes. Tommy knew they felt that way, though he didn't know the full extent of the distaste they felt for him. His father knew it, though. Victor Borodini turned a blind eye to much of what Tommy did, and he asked few questions because he didn't really want to hear the answers. He was fond of Polly because he reminded him of his late wife, and he felt Rick had potential, but Tommy was the one who'd have to take over when he was too old to run things. And maybe he could do it, too, if he could learn to control his goddamn temper and stop acting like a loose cannon. The way to help him do that, Borodini thought, was to give the boy responsibility. And though Tommy was a little crazy and a bit too heavy-handed, he had never let him down. Till now. "You wanted to see me, Papa?" Victor Borodini did not reply at once. He simply sat there and gave his son a level stare, thinking as if he could beam the message to him telepathically. "Come on, Tommy. Look me in the eyes. God damn it." But no, Tommy met his stare for perhaps 3 seconds, and then, as always, he looked away. "I gave you a job to do, and you disappointed me," said Borodini quietly. Tommy felt a knot forming in his stomach. "I told you I wanted Steele taken care of," Borodini said. "So what did you do?" Tommy swallowed nervously. I said Crivelli," he said. "You said you wanted to be sure. Crivelli's our best shooter." "One man," said Borodini dryly. "You said one man against someone who took on a whole street gang like the Chingos by himself?" He snorted. "I just saw it on the news. That TV reporter, Linda Tellerman, was right there when it went down, and she got it all on tape.
Crivelli missed his shot and Steele nabbed him. And he got him to confess you were the one who sent him. You realize what that means? Tommy said nothing. It means now there's a federal warrant out for your arrest, his father continued in a level tone. And as for my arrest as well, and it means they've got a witness who will testify against us. The warrant itself is of no concern to me. It's the mileage they can get from it that bothers me. Tommy frowned. I don't understand. I know you don't, said Borodini. That's the trouble. There's a lot more to running this family than simply being strong, Tommy. You got to be smart as well. You have to know to figure the odds and play the percentages. Right now, we're strong, and the feds can't touch us, but that's not going to last. We have to think about the future. Little by little, we're going to start pulling back this country together. We've got a good thing going, but if we don't grow, sooner or later, they'll run right over us. Getting control of the gangs is only the first step. We need to control the city. We need to take over the power structure so that nobody, not the Delanos or the Pastores or the Castellanos or any of the other conclaves, can get big enough to threaten us. And then, if any of the other cities need to deal with Midtown, they'll have to deal with us. I need for you to understand this, Tommy, he continued. The way to fight the establishment is to become the establishment. You don't take over the establishment the way we took over the gangs. Force is only a small part of it. You got to use the people. You got to convince them that what you've got to offer is a better deal than what the competition's got. And once you've got the people on your side, you've got the competition licked. You see what I'm saying? Yes, Papa. They can call us criminals, Borodini continued. And they can accuse us of any damn thing they want. But the bottom line is, if they haven't got the proof, if they haven't got something they can make stick in a court of law, they're just blowing smoke. It won't stop them from coming after us, but it'll keep us looking good. And they can say they run the city and the gangs, and we can say we just do business with them. It's our right. And the harder the gangs get to the city to control, the more the people will start wondering if maybe we couldn't do a better job, because we can do business with them. They'll look at the crime rate they've got. They'll think the Borodini enclave has no crime. The Borodini can give their people security. They'll look at the problems that they've got with shortages, and they'll think the Borodini enclave has no shortages. And they can do business with the Brood. They can do business with the freebooters. They can do business with anyone it takes to get their people taken care of. Why can't the city do that? And they'll start to think that maybe everything that I've been saying in the papers and on the talk shows is all true. Maybe the feds are really after me because I took control of this part of the island when they turned their back on it, and I'm doing a better job of taking care of things than they are. And maybe they're afraid of the people finding out that I can run their city better than they can. They're trying to blame me for all their problems because they're afraid of the people finding out the truth. And maybe the people will start wondering if it's true what I've been saying, that the city administration is corrupt and putting out the blame on me. And maybe they'll start wondering if they shouldn't have a better choice. Do you understand what I'm saying, Tommy? We wouldn't have to take over the city by force. The people would invite us in. But that won't happen if the feds can hit us with charges they can make stick, he continued. It won't happen if we start looking bad. It won't happen if someone like Steele captures their imaginations and becomes a hero to them. They'll start to listen to that fucking robot goes on TV and calls me a maggot and a slime. You understand what I'm saying, Tommy? If the people accept that idea, we have a pile of trouble in our hands, and everything I've worked for all these years will turn to shit. And I'm not about to let that happen. I want Steele taken out for keeps. I want him put down so hard, there's nothing left of him for them to rebuild. You understand me? What about Crivelli? Tommy asked. Don't you concern him yourself with him, said the elder Borodini. I'll put out the word and make sure that the squealers made an example of. You just worry about Steele. I'll take care of it, Papa, Tommy said. I'll go make sure there won't be any mistakes this time. There better not be, Borodini said. One is all you get. End of chapter.